Okay. I want to mention something that's sort of implicit that I never explained, and that is, so back to our big neuron picture. Let's just draw it with an apical dendrite. The problem of describing the input-output relation of this neuron is really a deep and fascinating problem and very hard. So the problem really is that out of this neuron comes a spike train, and into this neuron comes 10,000 spike trains, okay? And we have to describe, you know, that input-output relationship. So in here, you know, times 10,000. That's the basic problem. And, you know, you could talk about this endlessly. It's a fascinating and important subject. But implicit in what I've been talking about with firing rate models is kind of dividing this problem in half. And it's as if you cut this shaft here and treated the bottom half of this problem as one problem and the top half as another problem. And we've essentially done the bottom half. Namely, you say, well, I don't know what's going on up here, but I know ultimately that some current is going to be flowing down that shaft, go to the soma. And therefore, if I can describe how the soma responds to current and puts out a spike train, at least I'll understand the bottom half of this picture. And that's useful because you can most easily inject current into a neuron in its soma, and so you can say, okay, well, to study the bottom half of this problem, I could just take that same current, inject it into the cell, and look what's going on and build the models. And so the bottom half problem, this part of the problem, is what I've tried to describe before the break by this equation, okay? Or whatever. I mean, you know, you can build whatever model you want to try to describe that half, but we're going to use that particular model. And now we're getting to the point where we got to deal with the upper half, because this is fine if you inject current into a neuron, but now if we want to build networks, we've got to face the fact that that current doesn't come from you know, outside or up from the blue, but it comes from the other neurons within the network. And so up here, it's what I wrote down before, you have to describe this current as some function of the inputs to the neuron. And in particular, in a firing rate model, all of these inputs are described by firing rates. So again, we're going to have to describe this function. So when I ended up before lunch, that's really what we're thinking about. And then we're all set, right? Because now we can fold the two together, glue the neuron back together, and use this current in place of that function. Okay, that's what we're doing. Okay, so there's something else I was going to mention too. Does anybody remember? It's always because people ask me good questions and then I think, oh, I forgot to say that. But I can't remember the other one. Maybe whoever asked me the question, if you remember. I don't know. Okay, maybe I'll think of it. Okay. No. All right. So what's this function? Well, this function is obviously the harder part. It's both experimentally the harder part, and it's theoretically the harder part. Experimentally, because it's much easier to work at the soma of a neuron where it's big, you can see what you're doing. But in recent years, people have started patching out on the dendrites and venturing out into this territory of the neuron. They're never going to get way, way out there, at least not with present techniques. It eventually, these processes get so fine that you can't patch an electron on. But they're going that direction. And so we're starting to accumulate the kind of knowledge experimentally that we're going to need for this function. For example, now people can do experiments where they actually patch the electrode out here and inject the current out there, and sometimes they see a difference. Sometimes it doesn't do exactly the same thing as if you injected the current in here. So we're beginning to get that kind of evidence, but it's hard and it'll take some time. The other thing you can do, of course, is theoretical calculation. So you can build a model with a dendrite, exactly the kind of stuff that I showed you this morning. This morning I was comparing a simple model of a soma to a firing rate model. Well, you could also take whatever you think this equation is here and build a multi-compartment model, put some inputs in it, and see how you're doing. So I'm not going to do that, and I haven't done that, but one could do that. And so all that's a prelude to the fact that I'm going to write down the simplest possible thing you could possibly write down here, which is basically a linear sum. Okay? So let me write down the answer, and then we can talk about it. So what many, many firing rate models use for this term is you just take a sum of all the firing rates weighted by something which is often called a synaptic weight. So you take something like that. I'll call it W for now. Okay. What's the justification for this? Well, the justification would really be that every time a spike comes in, a little bit of current gets injected into this dendritic tree. That current, ultimately, some fraction of it comes down and ends up here. And so in that idea, this W would reflect a really an effective synaptic strength, both the amount of current that is injected by the synapse when the action potential arrives, plus some factor that accounts for the attenuation of the current as it goes down the cable. So it's an effective synaptic strength viewed from the soma. The idea of linear summation is, again, the simplest thing you can imagine. It's undoubtedly not true, but again, in experiments, it often isn't that far from true. It's surprisingly not far from true. And then there's the thing that we've taken that spike and represented by its probability, right? So we're taking, again, an actual pattern of synaptic inputs and replacing it with a probability of occurring. And again, I mentioned this morning, the basis of that is that although that is incorrect at any one input, perhaps if the inputs are all uncorrelated with each other, summing over all of them, you should get the right answer, even though on each one you're only describing probabilistically what's going on. So anyway, with all that prelude, that's the kind of firing rate model that I'm going to consider, that as far as I know, Sebastian's going to consider it by tomorrow. And indeed, I think on Friday, Misha Sadiks will also consider models like this and their role in associative memory. So there's a huge body of work in models of this class. And I'll talk about their relationship to spiking models a little bit along the way, especially if somebody reminds me. Okay, now the only thing we have left is one more thing, but it's trivial. I've described for you there as if one neuron is being driven by a whole lot of others. But we really want a network, right? We really want to imagine we have n neurons. They're coupled to each other in all sorts of different ways, however you want it, something like that. Perhaps they also receive an external input. That's probably a good idea, so we can probe the system. We want an arrangement like that. So if I write down the equation, I think it'll be obvious to you what's going on. Clearly, I need a label, so I'll index the firing rates of the neurons with a label that goes from 1 to n, okay, up to n. And then each of them satisfies an equation identical to this, with this sum put in, and the only thing is I need now, instead of a vector of synaptic weights, I'm going to need a matrix, and I'm going to label it with a W. So if I write down the answer, I think you'll see right away what's going on. So I'm going to write the input, let's say here's neuron I, as an external input that I'll call H sub I. So this is H sub I. It's coming from another area. That might be in a visual model. It might be an LGN input. That's modeled not within the network, but externally. And then here, I take and sum over all of the different cells of the network, so that's a sum over everybody else, a coupling strength, but now it's a matrix because this is the analog of like a WJ over there. This is the strength of a synapse or a connection between neuron J and neuron I. So this would be MIJ here. So the index convention is from J to I, and then proportional to the firing rate of J. So that equation there is what most firing rate models are based on, an analysis of that equation. And here, tau, and again, in keeping with this morning's talk, should be something on the order of the synaptic time constant, a short 1, 2, 3 millisecond time constant, but with the understanding that that's, you know, there's a little error in that. Okay, so everything I'm going to do, and as far as I know, everything the other guys are going to do, is going to be based on that equation. And really, the name of the game here is to say, how does this matrix M and its properties affect the responses that you get? Okay? And when I was talking about things, you know, yesterday when I sort of set this up at the end of the day, I was talking about, we're going to ask questions like, in visual cortex, is the inherent circuitry of the cortex responsible for various types of selectivities, or is that on the input? Well, you can see what I was leading up to. In other words, are these responses selective, let's say, to orientation because that's selective to orientation, that external input, or because there's certain properties of that matrix which make it selective to orientation? Or with complex cells, is a complex cell complex because of the nature of this input or because of the nature of that matrix? And obviously, to most modelers, the more interesting possibility is that it comes from the matrix. What properties of the matrix of connections within cortex would give you certain types of responses? And in a way, what I'm going to show you, and I'll show you some computer examples, is just a grab bag of what you can get. I mean, it doesn't hurt us as theorists to just investigate what can you get out of a model like this and make a catalog, and then as we see phenomena in nervous systems, say, hey, wait a minute, I know where that one comes from. I have a way of getting that. So it's almost in that spirit that I want to present this. All right, well, I'll tell you, I mean, this is both a natural way to do it, but If I'm thinking of a problem and I say, gee, would a recurrent matrix, would a recurrent network like this, for those of you who aren't biologists, recurrent, it's kind of a horrible word, but it seems to have stuck in my brain, and it just means that neurons are connected to each other in loops somehow, and that's the structure of this kind of model. Okay, anyway, if you're trying to say, well, could I explain a certain phenomenon with this, it doesn't hurt to start out by looking at the linear form of this model, where you can really work out everything. And then see, if your idea works, and then build the more complex nonlinear one. Perhaps you might have to run it on a computer, unless you're clever enough to figure out how it works anyway, and then see if your idea survives. So that's what I want to do. I want to start off on the blackboard analyzing this as a linear system, and then I'm going to show you a bunch of simulations where it's run as a nonlinear system, and just show you the bag of tricks that this system is capable of. Okay, so what do we mean by the linear thing? We mean that function f is just going to be a linear function. And in fact, given that I can scale the rate however I want, it means I'm going to turn that equation into this equation. Plus the sum. Okay? This is a plus sign. Now, the biggest sin that I've just committed is the sin of negative firing rates. Because you can always work in regime. I mean, if these firing rates start to go in infinity, that's the other thing, that this probably saturates this function, right? You can't, real neurons don't fire infinitely fast. But if this is going to infinity, you know you got a problem anyway, right? That's not, neurons in the brain don't even fire at their saturation threshold. They tend to fire pretty slowly. So that's not the problem. The problem is that this is going to allow negative firing rates, which aren't allowed by a realistic model. And that's the major source of error in what I'm going to do. But nevertheless, I think it's instructive to see what a model like this can do, how it behaves. Okay, so how do you solve this model? Do you solve it by diagonalizing the matrix Mij? And to make things simple, I'm going to assume it's a symmetric matrix, which means it has a complete set of orthogonal eigenvectors and the eigenvalues are real. That'll help us. But it doesn't have to be. It's going to make it simpler. So the idea, I mean, many of you probably know this, but in case you don't, I'll go and kind of step through it. And it never hurts to review good old linear algebra. The idea is that you find a set of special vectors which satisfy the following equation. That when you multiply these vectors by the matrix, you get the same vector back again. multiplied by a number. Okay? So you look for solutions to that equation. And the reason, you'll see why in a second if you don't already know, by using these as a basis, you turn matrix algebra into regular algebra, and regular algebra is a lot easier than matrix algebra. No, EI. J is being summed over. Okay? So in other words, you take a matrix times a vector, you get the vector back again. So this is a J. Maybe this is a problem. Okay. For an n by n matrix, so this is an n by n matrix, right? Every neuron potentially, there can be zeros in it, but every neuron potentially is coupled to every other neuron. Oh, I promised I would say something about feedback, so maybe I'll take an intermission and do that. There are n of these, so let's label them with an index mu, and we'll label eigenvalues. So they're going to be n of them. And for a symmetric matrix, they are orthogonal up to degeneracies in the eigenvalues, but then they can be orthogonalized. So you can always choose them such that if you take the sum over I of E mu I, E nu I, you get delta mu nu. You can also normalize them. Okay, so they act like an orthogonal coordinate system of unit vectors. And then the idea is to use them as a basis. The idea of linearizing, diagonalizing matrix is to use these as a basis. In other words, to write the firing rate of every neuron as a function of time. That's what we want here, right? As a sum over all the different eigenvectors of some kind of coefficients that are functions of time times these vectors. So this is exactly like when you use a Cartesian coordinate system, right? You write any vector in the space as a set of coordinates times a set of unit vectors that represent the x, y, z axis. This is the same story. It's an n-dimensional space, but you're using these orthogonal eigenvectors as a basis. Okay, so if you plug this in, the miracle of matrix diagonalization will occur. So what we're going to do is plug in this form for the thing. Now, I guess I should mention that the theorems say that these are orthogonal and they are a complete set. So any vector, any R, doesn't matter what R is, I can always expand it this way. So I haven't lost anything by doing this. Okay, so if I plug that into that equation, what do I get? Well, here, the eigenvectors are constants. So over here, I get the derivative of the coefficient with respect to time. So that's that term. Then on the right side, I get minus the firing rate. Well, that just ends up being this. Mu I. And I get H. Nothing happens to H. But then the nice thing happens. I won't belabor it. But what's going to happen here, you see, when I put in the E for R here, I'm going to get the matrix multiplying E. And by using this equation, that just gives me E back again multiplied by a number. That's the whole point of the exercise. The idea is that this matrix acting on an E is the same as a number acting on an E. So it changes matrix algebra into regular algebra. So I'll write down the answer. I guess I won't bother to really do it. Where am I? So this is going to be a sum over mu so what happens due to the fact that the matrix has multiplied is you just pick up a factor of the eigenvalue and then back times the thing again. So that's just a direct plug-in. So what I've used so far is the fact of, I've used this equation, basically, the fact that matrices multiplying these eigenvectors are just numbers times the eigenvectors. And then, now I'm going to use this equation. So you can project out one of these components simply by dotting this into, let's say, E nu. So if I take a sum over I from 1 to n of E nu times this whole equation, then if you notice, the E nu gets dotted into an E mu here, the E nu gets dotted into an E mu here, the E nu gets dotted into an E mu here, and by that delta mu nu, that pulls out from all these sums. It's going to kill all the sums over mu. It pulls out the term with mu equals nu in the sum. So this whole equation simplifies to this equation. This pulls out the nu term here, it pulls out the nu term here. That term's a little different. That leaves the dot product. H I E nu I. And it pulls out the mu term here, plus lambda nu. C nu. Okay? And lo and behold, you know, all this algebra, you now have a set of uncoupled equations. If you notice, the thing that made these equations somewhat hard is that the equation for R1 involved R35 and R17. But this case, the C's, C1 only has C1 and C1 in it, and that's a constant. It doesn't depend on C. So this is now, it has decoupled the problem and it's trivial to solve. Yeah, what depends, this does.
Right,
which makes, yeah. So if it isn't symmetric, you have to work harder to get this projection to work.
What does symmetric mean in terms of the actual network?
Yeah, so it means something that isn't really going to be true for neurons. It means that whatever the strength of that coupling, that one's the same. So, you know, because this is I and J, so this one would be MIJ, and this would be MJI. So then those have to be equal. Okay? So it's not like, I mean, you can do this sort of analysis if that's not true. I don't want you to think, but not on the board, not simply. I mean, it just gets more messy. You have to put in matrices that account for the non-orthogonality of the basis, and it's a pain in the neck. Okay, so where was it? All right, so we can just solve this equation. By I, essentially. It's just an exponential equation. And just write down the answer for C, and then write down the answer for R. And although it's a bunch of algebra, all will be revealed pretty soon. So C nu of T, just by integrating this equation, is equal to, maybe I should just define the projection. Let me define a thing called H nu, which is just the dot product of your input onto this new eigenvector, okay? So it's, again, in the coordinate system, it's just taking the input as if it was a vector and looking at its new component of that. And then that means this term here just becomes H nu. It simplifies things a bit. Then I can just write down the answer. So C nu of T is equal to H nu over 1 minus lambda nu. The idea here is that this is just a standard linear first order differential equation, but the term involving C nu on the right hand side doesn't have a 1, it has a 1 minus lambda in front of it. Right? It's a minus 1 here and a plus lambda. And so that's why you'll keep seeing terms divided by 1 minus lambda. So the, what is it? It's C nu of 0 here, H nu 1 minus lambda nu, and then e to the minus t 1 minus lambda nu. Over. Trust me. Try it yourself. That's the solution of that equation. It's just an exponential decay to a steady state given by H nu over 1 minus lambda, which you can all just see by setting this to 0, that's the steady state. Okay. So what do you learn from this? Well, let me just finish reminding you that then to get back to the original R's that I wanted in the first place, I just have to take these solutions and sum them up, these coefficients, times the eigenvectors. Okay. So what you see here is the two main things that happen in this network, and this will survive the nonlinear regime. The two things that a recurrent network can do for you. One is amplification, and one is slowing down of the dynamics. The amplification you can see right here. Suppose that one of the lambdas is pretty close to 1, Okay? Well, maybe I should start with the stability problem. So, sorry. If you notice here, something screwy happens when lambda goes to 1, right? If one of the lambdas, if a particular lambda nu goes to 1, you're going to get 1 over 0. Something weird's happening. I'll come back and consider that case in a second, what happens when lambda goes to 1. But what happens when lambda is even bigger than 1? Then it looks like, you know, this is going to be a negative sign. But you remember, you've gone through an infinity in the denominator. If you go back to over here, you can see that what really happens is if lambda is bigger than 1, this is a minus 1 in front of the C, but a plus, you know, some number like 2 in front of the C. This equation becomes flips from being a stable exponential equation where you get an exponential decay to a steady state. It flips to a situation where it's just unstable. So one must not make lambda bigger than 1. Otherwise, it's got a disaster, and that disaster is epilepsy, basically. It's a network which has excited itself so strongly through this matrix of connections that it just takes off on its own, independent of the inputs. So the first rule, then, is that all of the eigenvalues must be less than 1, less than or equal to 1, if this thing is going to work at all. So let's say the biggest one, let's just talk about the biggest eigenvalue. Let's say the biggest one is lambda 1. We just arbitrarily choose. That's the largest eigenvalue. Let's look at it. So let me leave this equation. Yeah. The thing that you need, right, is this E. I'm using that statement in two ways. The fact that the eigenvectors are orthogonal, this statement, is guaranteed if the matrix is symmetric. So therefore, I didn't have to tell you if you can orthogonal, blah, blah, blah. The other thing is that the eigenvalues are real. And there's nothing wrong with the eigenvalues being complex, but I'm treating them as real. So you just think of it as it cleanses my conscience. It's not really a major hurdle, but it means I can just tell you all these things without having to make provisos.
Do you really need that?
I use this to simplify the equation, so you don't need it. I mean, you don't need it. If you run this, a simulation of this with a non-symmetric matrix, 9 times out of 10 it'll do just what you think it's going to do. The most interesting thing that you can get with a non-symmetric matrix that you can't get with a symmetric one is oscillations, which comes from the complex eigenvalues. So, okay, all right. So let's write down the coefficient of the response for number one, and protect. Let's look at what it does at t equals infinity. So for long times, this exponential factor is going to go away, so it becomes h1 divided by 1 minus lambda 1. Okay. Now, if lambda 1 is near 1, then you get what I was saying is this phenomenon of amplification. Namely, h1 characterizes the strength of the input. But now that is being multiplied by a factor that can get really arbitrarily large if you let lambda get close to 1. So the first feature you see that comes out of a recurrent network, and it's not a big surprise, by feeding back excitation on the network, you can get amplification. And amplification occurs as one of the eigenvalues, and I've chosen lambda 1 because it's the biggest one and none of them can get bigger than 1, approach 1. And of course, what you're doing here is tickling that instability. You're getting close to the instability, but you don't want to go too far or things go bad. Okay. The other thing that happens that's interesting about this is the amplification is not an arbitrary amplification, it's selective amplification. Namely, if you have a situation like this, then the response R is going to be dominated by this term. If lambda 1 is close to 1, but none of the other ones are, let's say, all the other ones are much less than 1, then this term is going to get so much bigger than the other ones that the response should be completely dominated by this first eigenvector. Now, obviously, you could have two eigenvalues close to one, or other cases like that, and perhaps Sebastian will talk about those cases. But let's do just one eigenvalue close to one. So the response becomes dominated by a certain pattern of activity, and furthermore, that pattern of activity is only selective to a certain feature of the network, of the inputs, namely H1. So in other words, this response is proportional to the dot product of the inputs onto a particular vector direction, namely the first eigenvalue, and it's amplified. So you see there's a way of amplifying particular selectivities here by choosing the eigenvectors correctly. And this is the idea that leads you to say, aha, maybe I could get directional selectivity this way, because I'll choose the projection of the input that gets amplified to be a directionally selective projection, so that this part of the input here is a highly directionally selective component of the input, and get rid of all the other junk. So you can generate a selectivity. You all can still kind of filter. So I guess the next thing I should say here is you can get a selectivity in the network, a selectivity to things that point in the direction of this eigenvector that has an eigenvalue close to one. You can pull signals out of noise this way, right? If you're interested in this projection of the input, but the rest you consider garbage, well, you can pull out something. So you can get a selectivity, and this is the basis for both of the visual models I'm going to talk about. Although they aren't in the linear regime, they both create selectivity, a certain kinds of selectivity in visual neurons by choosing cleverly the eigenvalue that they want to amplify. Okay, the third feature that you can get concerns this term here. So if you notice, I was talking there about the asymptotic limit when you can ignore this, but this term tells you how rapidly do you approach that asymptotic limit. And what you notice is the original time constant that governed this, that I mentioned was sort of a synaptic time constant, is in here, but it gets divided by a factor of 1 minus lambda. So at the same time that if I'm doing the same example where I pull out one eigenvalue and make it close to one, the time constant relevant to this particular mode of the network is not lambda, but it's lambda divided by 1, it's not tau, I'm sorry, it's tau divided by 1 minus lambda 1. So you get a slowing down or sort of like a memory, what's called a reverberation, in that the, for example, if you turn off a stimulus, rather than decaying away with a time constant of tau, a few milliseconds, it decays away with a slower time constant. The network maintains the activity for a while and it goes down more slowly. Yeah.
So how do we understand this time constant in the rate model in terms of the time constants in the two models before you had for single cells, the grand fire cells, where you weren't sensitive to the membrane? How do I relate this tau?
Yeah, it's no longer related because this term is induced by the coupling within the network, right? This is a network.
So what's that tau that you put on?
That tau, yeah, is either the synaptic or the membrane tau. And this morning, right, I showed you that in some cases it should be one, in some cases it should be the other. There is no answer to that question.
But then experimentally it becomes confusing because then you're saying if in fact the network interactions are stronger, it would be the synaptic tau that's becoming longer sort of based on the interactions.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what it is, right, it becomes longer,
right,
due to the synaptic interactions. The problem is that the equations I'm dealing with really don't describe the firing rate dynamics properly. But, you know, let's work in the range where it never stops firing. Then it's a synaptic time constant. It's probably best to think of it as a synaptic time constant. Network effects mean that the effective time constant of the network is longer than that time constant by some factor that's determined by the eigenvalue. The eigenvalue. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah, yes, you could, right. This could be, and then this tau would be like a projection of that tau vector onto the, yeah, right, you could do that. Okay, so you get this reverberation slowing down effect. And that is useful. I'm not going to show you really an example of that to tell you the truth, but if you you just keep it in the back of your mind, because if you ever have a model where you need a short-term memory of something within your model and you can't, you know, think of any fundamental, you know, you don't have slow synapses or something where you can do this, you can always get a memory for a while of something in a network model by choosing, again, correctly the coupling matrix so it has the eigenvalue that you want.
You're asking for a very delicate balance because you have a synaptic time of milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're asking for behavioral time is sort of tens of milliseconds, maybe you're asking for a memory which is hundreds of milliseconds. You're asking for balance at kind of a one-time level.
That's Sebastian's problem, unfortunately, not mine. But exactly. I mean, sure, Sebastian will talk about this, that if you want this to be hundreds of milliseconds, you know, what David says is exactly right, that if you don't have slow synapses, then this lambda has to be extraordinarily close to 1. And remember, beyond 1 is a disaster point. And that is a problem that really, I think Sebastian can say he disagrees, does not presently have a satisfactory solution of how a network could arrange things. Now, things can be better in the nonlinear regime. You can protect yourself somewhat against this. But I think the problem of fine-tuning in these things doesn't go away in the nonlinear regime. You can make the severity of screwing up a little better. But nevertheless, there is a fine-tuning problem here if you want this to be really long. One thing you can do to alleviate that, and Sebastian has done it and other people in some models, is to make use of the fact, I mean, this isn't made up, in cortex, other parts of the brain, in addition to the fast excitation that I've talked and inhibition that I've talked about, there are slower forms. So there are forms where that synaptic time constant could be 100 milliseconds or something, and then it's less severe of a tuning problem. But nevertheless, to get the kind, especially Sebastian is going to talk about systems with incredibly long memory or integration times, even then there's somewhat of a fine-tuning problem, even when you use slow synapses. So it's a good question. Yeah?
Why can't the lambda be?
It can be negative, yes. No, negative lambda here is going to make the denominator bigger, right? Which makes it shorter. No, they just have to be real. Somebody doing something stupid, right? This lambda, as lambda gets negative, this gets smaller, the thing gets faster, you want it to be slow. So you want lambda to be very close to 1, as big as you can make it. So negative lambda is fine. I mean, it doesn't do anything interesting. Okay, so you have these features. And finally, let me just show you a limit that really Sebastian will talk about. You might say, okay, what happens right on the boundary? What happens when lambda equals 1, which is really at the edge of disaster? And to show you, I mean, it looks like all, you know, weird things are happening because I got infinities and denominators. If you expand and take the limit correctly, you can see that nothing weird goes on. But the best thing is to go back to the original equation and realize that what happens when lambda is 1 is that term and that term cancel each other, and the system changes from an exponential behavior to just being an integrator. In other words, the C just integrates the input. So the system becomes an integrator. And it's really kind of the infinite memory limit of this sort of reverberation idea. So in a particular limit, you can actually get an integrator. And you know, the kinds of models Sebastian will talk about are going to be on that limit of the game. Okay, now obviously you can play the game of having multiple eigenvalues close to 1, in which case, you know, this thing kind of lives on a line. In other words, you have a mode that grows large, and then you can change the length of that one vector. So this essentially takes the network and has it collapse onto a single direction. But if you had two eigenvalues close to one, you could collapse onto a plane or a three-dimensional space or whatever. There's obviously variants of this that I won't belabor. Well, and say anything else. Okay, any questions about this? So this is the linear analysis. Oh. The who?
So the last one in here is to talk about the gain bandwidth. So if you have a feedback amplifier.
You mean this is the trade-off between this term and this term?
So the product of the bandwidth would be 1 over tau, and the product of the gain bandwidth is constant.
Right, okay. Yeah. Oh, so that's what they have a name for that?
Gain
bandwidth.
Is it gain bandwidth?
Right. Yeah, so if you notice the fact that tau gets increased by the exact same factor as the amplification means the rate gets decreased by exactly the inverse. That's what you're saying.
So negative with the fact used by you have an op-amp. You have a very high gain amplifier. And you put it in negative feedback and you lower the gain and you speed up the
It's an example where you start off with, whereas I'm imagining you start off with a low gain and build a high gain, that's right. Yeah, good. Okay, any other comments, questions?
Yeah, so I'm just having a little issue. If you have a longer memory and you've got a slower response, aren't you just slowing down everything, or can you still have a very quick response?
Yeah. No, that is a good point, that in this dynamics, you pay the price of slow on time if you want slow off time, right? There's a symmetry. You slow down the network, right. Now, there are various ways around that and that aren't captured by this thing. Cortical responses tend to be transient, right? They tend to turn on rapidly and then adapt. And so you could get that back by putting that sort of dynamics into this model, which is not there. So there are ways to think of that symmetry, which you're right, is a problem here, because the price you pay for a memory is that it takes you forever to get there. By putting in, for example, driving this system with these transient inputs that push really hard at the beginning. But the model I've described has exactly the problem that you mentioned. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. And I should have mentioned that in all of this, I was assuming that there was an appreciable component in that direction. Otherwise, this first eigenvalue is irrelevant, and I would have to talk about the second eigenvalue or whatever. And then, yeah, agree. So I should have mentioned that. Thanks for reminding me. That obviously, if this projection is zero, then this is no longer the dominant mode. Or if it's very small for some reason. But for generic inputs, this is right then. Yeah, you're right. Yeah?
When you talk about degenerate eigenvalues, normally supposed to have some kind of symmetry, right?
Right, so that's what I was exactly talking about. That if you had two lambda 1 and lambda 2 were degenerate, then this whole thing, which is playing, you know, this is scaling the length along that E1 direction, now you're in a plane. And your amplified vector could lie anywhere in that plane, spanned by the two degenerate eigenvectors. So you exactly take advantage of what you're talking about, that you have a symmetry within that plane, and you can point anywhere in that plane. And in fact, I'm trying to think, yeah. Yeah. Yes. No, this is a very good comment that you make. In these sort of schemes, there's a great mathematics here. I don't know if Sebastian, if you've ever thought of this, but you know what you're asking a network to do here is, let's say, tune a particular eigenvalue of this matrix close to one, and also adjust the matrix so that this eigenvector is what you want. That's a very hard math problem, given that all you can do is adjust the elements of the matrix, and you're supposed to be able to figure out what to do to do this. Now, I mean, Sebastian has written papers in which there are learning rules that adjust one of these eigenvalues close to one, but it's not an easy thing to do, and it's not an easy thing to imagine biophysically how that occurs. So learning is a is an interesting issue. And it's always nagged me of whether there's some amazing matrix theorem, you know, where there are certain things you can do to a matrix that you know will adjust its eigenvalues in one way or the other. It would be really useful to know if there were such relations. Well, yeah, except I don't know. Sebastian, you know, maybe are you going to talk about your learning rule that you use?
If you took an outer product of one relation to another.
Yeah, I should mention that. I mean, the easiest way to make this matrix, it's easy to make it. The problem is if you find a matrix that already exists and you say, what should I adjust? I guess you could add this. Anyway, the way to make a matrix like this is just to write it as the eigenvalue we want times just the product of these things. So if you're willing to just start, just do that, that'll work. And I suppose it's just harder to know, you know, what you think learning is doing is, you know, making minute adjustments to different elements of the matrix to have this happen. That's what I'm saying would be hard to figure out how to do. You can make such a matrix. Actually, it's useful to know this. I'm glad Sebastian reminded me, because this is the easiest way to build a model like this. This has all the eigenvalues zero except for this one, and then that one is. Yeah, yeah, right. And then, yeah, exactly. Well, so now I'm stepping on Sebastian's lectures. I'll sit up on Misha's too. You can start adding additional terms here, and if these are independent enough, the eigenvectors, they won't interfere with each other. So Misha's going to talk about building matrices like that. Yeah, right. You said it. Right. I agree. These models, you know, Sebastian will come back to this because, you know, he's probably worried the most about making his model of this form really comply with the biology. So I'll leave it to, it's also hard, so I'll leave it to Sebastian. Okay, so I guess, let me show you a few of these models, then we'll take a break. I actually don't have that. Maybe I should save a few examples to bring people back for the. Okay, I'll do a couple examples. Okay, so now what I want to show you is the nonlinear version of this. Maybe somebody can crank that up, of this model. No, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself. Don't do it yet. Sorry. Maybe what I'll do, I got it. I'll explain to you what I'm going to do and to myself, and then we'll look at the models after the break. Sorry. So let me tell you about it. I'm going to look at this model that, as I say, came out of the Sompolinsky group of orientation selectivity in primary visual cortex. But I'm going to show you, I'm going to basically use it to show you every trick that I know that these systems can do. But the model looks like this. So it's the same model I've been talking about. Let's write it out. And the function being used is a linear threshold type function. And I think they also put in saturation, but it actually doesn't make any difference. So the function we're talking about as a function of I looks like this. At some point, there's a threshold, and the thing starts going up linearly. And if you want, you can imagine that it's also clipped off there. But I think nothing I'm going to do relies on that, so it doesn't really matter. It can either do that or not. Okay, and it's the usual, just like what I've been talking about, but I'm putting in the nonlinearity again. And in particular, we're getting rid of the negative rates. MIJRJ. Okay, so I might as well explain it to you as an orientation model, but I want you to not get too wedded to orientation because we're going to use it for everything in sight, everything we can think of. But in terms of orientation, what they imagined was that the input to the model had a certain orientation selectivity. So their theme here was to look at this example where you say, I want to see, can I make a matrix that'll amplify the selectivity of the neuron for orientation? So they wrote their input as being, let me, I'll write it down exactly like they did with their little epsilons and everything. They wrote their input as, well, first of all, I guess I got to tell you one more thing. So every neuron is characterized by an angle, which is going to turn out to be its orientation selectivity. So you assign to every neuron an angle, which is its preferred, thank you, so I'm going to kill myself here, its preferred orientation. But for now, just think of that as a label. It's an alternative label to the eye, if you want. It's just another label that goes on with the neuron. And then they are going to write HI and MIJ in terms of that angle rather than just in terms of I and J. Turns out to be easier to do that. So the input looks like this. So there's this irritating feature about orientation selectivity that, you know, if you think of about a bar, the angle of orientation of a bar only goes to 180 degrees, right? Once you get here, you're back to where you started. And so you're going to see all these twos in the cosines. You just kind of ignore them, but I'll put them up. But it's just in order to change the periodicity from 360 degrees to 180 degrees, just because orientation has this weird feature. It actually doesn't really do anything in the model. I could give you a 360-degree version of this model, but I might as well stick to what they do. Okay, so the input, the basic idea here is C is the strength or the contrast of the input. C just says how strong is the visual input to this network. But epsilon is a variable that determines how selective for orientation is that input. You see, for each neuron, the selectivity of the input is being modulated by its selectivity, by its theta value. But if epsilon is zero, then it no longer is, right? Then the input is exactly the same to every neuron. And if epsilon is like one, then in fact there's no constant term and there's a huge modulation of the input from neuron to neuron. So the nice thing about parameterizing the input like this is they can go from a case like epsilon 1 where the orientation selectivity is already on the input and there's really nothing to explain to a case where epsilon is very, very small and you wouldn't be able to account for the degree of orientation selectivity of cortical neurons unless you amplify that selectivity somehow. Okay, so what about MIJ? Well, for them, MIJ has almost exactly the form of outer product as we were talking about just a few minutes ago. So first of all, they put in a uniform inhibition. So they put in a constant negative term. I'll show you when we turn on the simulation what that's for. So constant inhibition, it's essentially to keep the receptive field kind of bounded. But the amplification term we're talking about is you want something, let me write it down, you'll be able to see that it's an outer product form. So it's cosine of 2 theta I minus theta j. In other words, you couple two neurons in proportional to the cosine of their orientation angles. Now, the reason that this you can think of as an outer product is that they're building a translationally invariant network here. That means the eigenvectors are cosines and sines. And, you know, because of the identity of a cosine, you know, of a difference of angles is the cosine times the cosine, you know, this would be cosine theta I, cosine theta j plus cosine plus sine theta I, sine theta j. That's why it's an outer product form. So let me write it out. It's the stupid twos that are screwing me up, but so what is this? This cosine of 2 theta I, cosine of 2 theta j minus plus 2 theta I sine 2 theta j. And these cosines and sines are exactly the eigenvalue. So this is a case of a degenerate eigenvector. Because of the symmetry of the network, cosine and sines are degenerate eigenvectors, and you've built an outer product form of the matrix. And that means you're going to multiply the mode proportional to cosine 2 theta. And that's the mode and the input. There it is, right? So this term here is going to result in an amplification of exactly the term in here that you want to amplify. So basically what I'm telling you is they knew what they were doing. They found the mode in the input that they wanted to amplify, and they built an outer product form for the matrix. And then by adjusting lambda, now in the linear model you want lambda to be close to 1. In the nonlinear model, you don't have to do that, because the difference is, you know, that all of these guys out here that would have a negative rate in the linear model aren't there anymore. And so you have, there's a different condition. But at any rate, there's values of lambda. So that's how they're going to do it. And we'll see after the break. Maybe I'll run through the models, and after the break I'll run the models. But we'll see how this works. Maybe I shouldn't do that. Okay. All right. And so that's basically the model. I guess I'll get it too ahead of myself if I do that. Do you want a break now? And then. Because I can do it. It won't take that long to run through the models. I want to show you the different things it can do. And
all right, let's just get together at 10 to 3. Right?
Okay. All right, so all I'm going to show you is a little program that just integrates those equations. They're simple equations, just integrates those equations kind of irritatingly flutters the solutions in front of your eyes. So what's being plotted here is the firing rate of every neuron in the network. You're going to see continuous curves drawn between them. But if you remember, in these networks, every neuron is identified by an angle, which is just another way of labeling it. And so what's being plotted here, these are the angle variables of the different neurons. So, and the firing rate is vertical here. So every neuron, if I plotted it in dots, every neuron would be a dot at a different angle, you know, corresponding to its particular angle. Now, I'm going to actually draw it as a continuous line just because I connected the line. So you'll actually see a continuous line. And likewise, this is the input to every neuron in the network. So if you look at 20, whatever the line is, that would be the input coming into neuron 20. Now, there's a feature, I probably should have done this on the board, but let me see if I can get you to believe it. This neuron is translationally invariant. That's a very important point. In other words, every neuron looks like every other neuron. Every angle looks like every other neuron. Until you turn on the input, there's no preferred angle. And because of that, the firing rate is only a function of the difference between the tuning angle, the angle, you know, theta of I, and the angle that the input's going to pick out. And as a result of that, the curves that you draw out here, you can either think of them as a picture of the entire population response, okay? So when you see a line and it looks like this or something, that's telling what every neuron in the population is doing. But you can also interpret it as the tuning curve for this particular neuron in the middle as a function of orientation. So the single neuron tuning curve and the population tuning curve are identical because they're both functions of the same combination, theta minus theta I. All right? So does everybody buy that? All right? So I'll flip between the two languages. In fact, I'll probably talk about this as if it's a single neuron tuning curve when it's really a population response, but it doesn't make any difference. If you want, because the neurons are identical, we can view the response of this neuron is identical to the response of this neuron if I shifted the input by 40 degrees, right? So they're the same. Okay, so initially this thing is running in a mode where it's completely uncoupled. So all that's happening here is that this is the input, okay? So you can see this would correspond to a highly tuned input for a bar oriented at 0 degrees. So the neurons that are preferentially tuned to 0 degrees are getting a lot of input, and it falls off, and it's highly modulated. So this is the example where the epsilon parameter is pretty big. Epsilon is 0.5, so it's 50% of the maximum modulation. So this is the amount of tuning on the input is controlled by this variable, 0.5. And then this is just the strength of the input, the contrast. Okay, all that we're doing at the present time is to take this input and feed it into the network. There's no recurrence, so Mij is 0, and get this output, and it's just being clipped from going negative by the nonlinearity. So this is just a rectified linear thing. So here's where that input at this point goes through the threshold. So the threshold must have been, I don't remember what it was, but it's something like that. Okay? So you get a tuning curve that looks like this, and as I mentioned, you can either think of this as the response of the population, so neurons tuned to zero, preferred orientation lie there, etc., or you can think of this as the single neuron tuning curve, the tuning curve of this neuron that has a preferred direction orientation of zero to different orientations. So in that interpretation, this axis would be the position of this input hump. Okay? Either way, take your pick. Okay, now, let me see what I'm actually going to do here. Okay. Now, this sort of model exhibits something called the iceberg effect. And I can show you that by just changing the contrast a little bit. So, let me crank this down a little bit. Okay, so what I did, when it flickers, that's just the integration of the differential equation, but it very rapidly hits its steady state and just flickers and irritates the heck out of you. Okay, what I did was lower the magnitude of this input signal as if I had a weaker input. And what you notice, what you should notice is this curve just sort of sinks like a sunset going down into the horizon. Let me move it back up again. We'll move it up to 2. Yeah, and if we move it up even more, it'll probably go off the top, but it doesn't matter. And you notice that as it comes up, as the sun is rising here, this used to terminate here or so. The curve is getting broader, just like it's like a big iceberg that goes down below into the basement, and we're rising it up as we rise this up. And of course, that's because this point here is just determined by wherever this curve hits the threshold of current that we've defined in the model where firing starts. So this exhibits a phenomenon called the iceberg effect. As it rises, it gets broader, and that's a problem. So if you wanted to argue this particular model as a model of orientation tuning, you wouldn't get it right. I can show you the data when I get this projector working. I have the example. But tuning curves of neurons in the real visual system exhibit the phenomenon of contrast-independent orientation tuning curves. I'll show them in the model in a second. In other words, if you measure a tuning curve of a neuron, of a real neuron, I'll just show you on here instead of showing you the data because I don't want to flip the projector on. You'll get a curve like this, and then when you turn down the contrast, you get a curve that's lower. You won't get as big a response, but it has the same width as it did before. So that was actually a big motivation in this work, was that people were trying to, who did this work, were trying to explain how you could get a contrast invariant response and not get this sort of iceberg effect out of the model. Okay, so, I can get rid of the iceberg effect pretty easily, actually. All I got to do is do this. So if I push this button, what's going to happen is the inhibition is going to come on. So now MIJ is uniformly negative. There is no amplification occurring yet, but there's a uniform negative inhibition on this network. So I've turned on part of the coupling. And what you can see is the inhibition squished in the tuning curve. The threshold hasn't changed here. It's still somewhere like here. But and you notice I also turned up the amplitude of the input tremendously. That's because the input, otherwise the input would have squashed the response altogether, the inhibition. But that uniform inhibition is cranking in the tuning curve and making it narrower. So this is the classic sort of lateral inhibition kind of effect. But it also is enough, I think it's enough, I was screwing around with this, to give you a contrast invariant response. So if let's mark it out. So this is going to about maybe between 25 and 30, right? In angle on the, it's coming down there. So let me change the contrast of the input and see what happens. Turn it down a little bit. I think it's pretty sensitive, right? It got a little narrow, but it doesn't do the iceberg thing. And let's make it bigger. I don't know if I'm going to get carried away here, but okay, you see it spread for a second, but it's I've sort of picked up one more neuron maybe, but you notice that although it's going through the roof here, it didn't get any broader. So the key, the idea here, I think, you know, Sebastian has a much more sophisticated way of explaining this, but is that you want the width of this tuning curve not to be determined by the input. Because the input, look how fat, you know, now the input's gigantic, and it's very fat above the threshold. You don't want this width to be determined by the input. You want it to be determined internally by the network, and in particular by the range of the inhibition, or how far you have to go to get the inhibition to kick in. So at any rate, they get rid of this that problem right off the bat. But now I want to show you the effect of amplification, which is the other feature of this model. So let me turn this down to the magic value that I wrote down. This is, when I say magic value, I really am just kidding. It doesn't matter, but I just know this will work all right. If my hands do work. Okay, so I'm going to run this again. All right, so this is the range where the Sompolinski gang likes to run this model. You notice what I've done here is to greatly, greatly weaken how much the input is modulated by angle. So, because I did that by turning down epsilon all the way down to 0.1. So now you have a case where there's only a weak dependence of the input on orientation, and there's a resulting kind of wimpy response here. But if I push this button, now what we're going to do is activate the term in MIJ proportional to cosine 2 theta. So I discussed before that there was a uniform inhibition term and then a positive term, well, it can be of either sign actually, but a term proportional to this cosine 2 theta, which is amplifying the mode here that corresponds to orientation selectivity. And if I run this, pow, up it goes. So this is an example then of this amplification by choosing the matrix correctly so that the eigenvector with an eigenvalue, in this case it's not close to 1, but it's an eigenvalue that's large, gets amplified, and now you get a big response out of that thing. Okay, let me understand. Okay. Yeah. I'll show you another example of this, but I might as well run this. This model does a sort of interesting thing that they mentioned as a... I'll just show it to you. I don't know what the hell it means. What happens here is if you change the orientation... So what I did was it's effectively like a rotated the input. I changed the orientation of the input to over here, and then let me now change it again. I'm going to change it to all the way over to there. What happens in this model is that rather than collapsing, the response walks across the cortex. So there's a sort of a prediction of this model, at least if you work in this parameter range, that you might see activity at intermediate orientations when you suddenly flip. So the experiment would be take a bar like this, suddenly flip it to that. And rather than just seeing a new response in cortex, they're predicting sort of a wave of activity going through different orientation zones until it alights on the other area.
It's a strong prediction.
Yeah, I mean, it ought to be pretty apparent.
It's very different than what you would have gotten in the
model. Right. That's right, because again, it's a feature that's not present on the input. The input instantaneously jumped from here to here. This is something generated within the cortex. So,
and
no.
Right.
You mentioned that it depends on the parameters. Is that something?
Yeah.
With these models, it's always hard to get real predictions, or is that reliable prediction?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't call it, if they didn't see that, it doesn't rule against this model. This has to be strong enough, internal connection, the connectivity has to be strong enough to maintain this bump all the way through. So, no, I wouldn't call it a particularly strong. In fact, in some limit that I'm about to show you, the model becomes a little ludicrous for that reason. I guess that's what I'm going to show you next.
It's just that you're pointing out, in the study, not this geometry, but it's Mercury wave retardant, so mm-hmm. it's a high position of coarseness. There's some experimental evidence that when you when you change the intended position of the eye, right, that the activity actually sort of sweeps through mm-hmm. the position that corresponds even to the initial position or the final position. Like move, they'll call it a moving hill.
Right.
Sorry.
Just wait. Okay. Epsilon controls the degree of which this is modulated by the input. It's a scaling of the cosine term. So let me show you. In fact, I'm about to show you epsilon equals zero. Okay? If I take off epsilon, this input is going to be flat. So now there's no longer any information about orientation coming in. And the model, as I configured it, now I mentioned it, I'm going to use this model for everything. It's going to do something that you would never want visual cortex to do. But so this is what I said. I said at some point you're going to have to divorce yourself from orientation. But it's an interesting feature of this model. So let me run it. I think I have the parameters right, which is it stays. Okay. So although there is no or there's an input here, right? There's something driving the network, but there's no orientation information on the input whatsoever, and yet that bump will sit there. So, you know, this isn't a particularly necessarily good model of V1, but it's an interesting thing that this network will do, which is that it will retain activity in a shaped pattern like this indefinitely, in this case, even when the input is completely symmetric. And furthermore, it will remember where it was. So, for example, if I turn this back on again, it's hard to do this with one hand. If I turn this back on again and move the bump over to the other side, so there it goes, and then I turn it off again, turn off the orientation selectivity input, you know, there it's going to sit there. It sits wherever it is. So this is a persistent activity memory thing, and this is the kind of thing that I won't talk about it too much because this is what Sebastian's going to talk about. So this is actually acting as an integrator. I mean, let me show you an example of sort of a slow integration. If I put on a very small I've put on a very, very weak orientation selectivity, and you'll get this very, very slow motion. This thing is drifting over very slowly. So what's happened, you can think of this, it's like having a ball in the bottom of a, you know, of a wine bottle. So you have a set of solutions that are exactly symmetric because of the symmetry of the network going all the way around from minus 90 to plus 90. And this blob of activity can sit anywhere you want along that path. I mean, if I do that again and send it back, and let it drift for a little while. So it's, you know, it's just, this is like, so I very slightly tipped the wine bottle and it's slowly drifting back. But if I just stop in the middle, it's just going to sit there. It sits wherever it stops. So it's acting as an integrator of its input, and then it just remembers that position forevermore. So by the symmetry of the model, we've constructed a set of states with identical properties, symmetric properties, and this hill of activity can sit anywhere. And so there's been a lot of interest in whether various forms of persistent, you know, memory, persistent activity memory can be accounted for. Now, Sebastian will get into this, but there's also sorts of hokey things about this, namely that mathematically you can build an exactly symmetric network, but it's not clear biologically you can like this. The other thing I should mention is that this really is related to the integrator I talked about before, although it seems different. Basically, you're using symmetry to guarantee that your stability matrix has an eigenvalue of exactly one. So the mode that corresponds to motion around this angle is like a lambda one of one. Okay, so that's the memory effect. And then finally, I want to...
This thing is a pi symmetric value, 180 degrees.
Yeah.
So if we're sitting at, say, 75 degrees,
mm-hmm.
then you go and flip to minus 75, wouldn't it be closer to go through 90 to come back to minus 90?
You mean, why isn't it going out this end and coming back when I do that? Yeah, I don't know why it didn't do that. I don't remember where these angles were. It certainly couldn't go around the end. I don't know why it didn't in that particular case. It could be that I'm probably right at the point where it sort of doesn't matter and it happens to go that way. But you're right. It could easily go out that angle and come back. Yeah. Yeah. Not. Right. Or, you know, I mean, if you've got a shaky hand, the ball's not going to stay in the bottom of the wine glass. And, you know, there's all that. I'll leave it to Sebastian to deal with those questions. You know, it's not a very robust model of persistent memory, but it's kind of cool to see that a bump of activity like that can exist, be stable. It doesn't go to infinity. I mean, there's not nice features of it, but there's the robustness of it is a problem. I mean, and Sebastian and I were just talking about various things that people have proposed to try to stabilize these corners against a little bit of a shaky hand or whatever. You know, so there's a lot of work done on this. Sebastian's going to talk about it. I won't belabor it. Okay, I think I'll skip my gain modulation example. Yeah, I'll do it. Okay, so I have one more example. You got to just set up the parameters in this do-all network. Okay, so I want to do that. Oh, I guess yeah. This one I just got to expand the scale a little bit. I don't know why I did it that way. Okay, this is kind of running fast, but okay. So I've just gone back to, for no apparent reason. I don't even remember why I did it this way, but here's quite a highly tuned input. Here's the output that you get from it. But there's an interesting feature of what happens if you just add a constant to this input. So all I'm going to do by changing some numbers is to shift this curve up again and down again. So it doesn't correspond to either of the things I've showed you yet. I've showed you what happens if you change the modulation degree of this curve, but I haven't shown you what happens if you just add a constant. And what happens is a scaling of the tuning curve. So let me do that. I think it's this one. Okay, let's say I do that. Okay, the thing just gets a little higher, right? Let me make a bigger effect. So up it goes. The whole curve rises, but again, it doesn't get much wider. And the reason this is of interest is because there's evidence in the nervous system that this can actually happen, that there are tuning curves that appear to be able to be scaled up by various inputs, things like attention or eye position, things like or neck position, can scale tuning curves like this without changing their width. And so this is a potential explanation of that phenomenon. So it's another thing that these networks can do. Okay, let me show you a few more things with this network, and then I'll show you some pictures. Okay, all right, so this is exactly the same network doing exactly the same thing. The only thing is it's getting like two inputs, okay? So it's been modified. Instead of just a singly modulated input, it's got two bumps in it. So this is as if, you know, like you showed two oriented bars at two different angles across or something like that. And this is the model without any recurrent connections. So this input's generating this bump, this input's generating this bump. This is a linear model, what you're seeing, linear except for the clipping, actually, so except for the rectification. So two inputs, you get two outputs. But if you turn on these recurrent connections, which I'll do by pushing this button, what you find is a winner-take-all situation. One of them wins. And again, the idea is that this network is set up to maintain a bump like that. It wants to make one bump. And so the reason it chose that one, I didn't show you, but this peak is a little bit higher than that one, just a tiny bit. And so you can get sort of a winner-take-all target selection sort of idea out of a network like this. So you might imagine that at that initial network might be, you know, your perception of two objects, but then a motor system might say, okay, I'm going for that one and select and just completely ignore the other one. And these kind of networks are capable of doing something like that. Okay. Let me show a couple of these. Maybe if somebody can cover that up or do something, I'll go back to it, but I want to show you a couple of transparencies. I'm just going to... Okay, let me see what I got here. The thing that I just didn't have an example programmed up, so I got to show you this one on transparency. Put down a slide. First of all, let me show you the orientation invariance of tuning curves. So this is—I'm sorry, this isn't in order, but I couldn't flip back and forth. So this is this idea that orientation tuning curves. So this is the data. So these are orientation tuning curves of real neurons. So you can see that their orientation is a real neuron. And the different curves here correspond to different degrees of contrast. And what you can see is that the width of the curve doesn't change, but its height just goes up. And that's reproduced here. This is just a picture like what I just showed you. This is reproduced in the model, where you get this effect that the tuning curves don't get wider, despite the fact that the input here is rising above threshold, and you could potentially get this iceberg effect. This model doesn't get it. So that's the evidence that the data actually agrees with the model here. The model agrees with the data. What I really wanted to show you is sort of noise tuning. And let me... Yeah, okay. So this is a linear network. This is exactly like the network that I started to analyze mathematically. And it's just an example of that network in operation. So this is an input to that network. And again, this is like the model I was just showing you. Every neuron has been identified with a degree with an angle. In this case, the angle goes all the way around the circle. There's none of these factors of two have been omitted. But anyway, so this is the input to every neuron in this network. It's a very jagged mess, complicated thing. And this is just the Fourier components of that at different harmonics of the basic period, which goes around in a circle. So this is a periodic input. So in other words, you just take that signal and do a Fourier decomposition of it, and here are the amplitudes of the Fourier components at different harmonics of the circle. And so it's got power, in other words, at many different frequencies. But in this example, we put this into a network which amplifies the first harmonic, or the first cosine, this mode. And so you can see that here, that once you put that into the network, it pulls out a sort of cosine-like or whatever, sine-like term, and greatly amplifies this one mode while leaving the others. You should notice the difference in scale here, right? You notice there's an amplification of this mode by a factor of 10. In fact, that's because the lambda was chosen so that 1 over 1 minus lambda was 10 in this example. So you get that great amplification of this one mode and not the other modes. But this is just the linear model. It's just doing exactly what I showed you analytically it would do. Here's exactly the same example done on a nonlinear version of this model. It's exactly the same connection matrix, but in this case, rectification has been added. And it sort of does the same thing. Namely, it takes a very noisy input and finds the component of it that kind of matches a particular shape. And this shape is really sort of the cosine shape. It's just been clipped by the rectification. However, it's not so simple, let's say, in terms of Fourier components. Because of the nonlinearity, you don't just amplify the first Fourier component. The components get mixed up. So it's not so simple. But you certainly can extract from this input a sort of a characteristic shape. It's in the spirit of like a Fourier composition with amplification, but it's not quite that. Okay. All right, I just have one more example to show, and then we can have a talk about things. So I wanted to show you one example that we developed, which was really a very much inspired by this Sampolinsky model. So in the Sampolinsky model, the idea was to try to take a selectivity that might be weakly present on the input and amplify it. Okay, so the idea was a selectivity was amplified by amplifying the selective mode. Okay, like the cosine mode, or the mode that's modulated by orientation. But it occurred to us that you could also do exactly the reverse. You can get rid of selectivity. So if you have a certain selectivity on the input, selectivity, you can get rid of it by amplifying non-selective modes. You do exactly the opposite, amplify non-selective modes. And get rid of a selectivity that's on the input, but you don't want. And we realized that this is exactly what you want for complex cells. So you might want this kind of thing for simple cells, in which case something like their selectivity to orientation, or take whatever you want, gets amplified. But to make a complex cell, what you want to do is just the reverse. You want to say, well, there's lots of selective neurons to spatial phase in visual cortex, but for some reason these complex cells don't reflect it in their output. Well, maybe that's because they're part of a network. They're coupled to each other in such a way that they amplify the mode that is spatially phase invariant, the constant mode, and therefore they lose their selectivity for spatial phase. And it's really easy to do this. Whoops, I have it right here. It's really easy to do this. The only difference is we're going to interpret this angle not as orientation but as spatial phase. I should really take away the two, but I'm not going to bother. And what we do is get rid of this, because we don't want to amplify selectivity, and just take the constant term, make it positive instead of negative, and we're therefore amplifying the constant mode. You can think of this as an outer product matrix, but the outer product is with one. You know, the vector 1, which is completely non-selective for any angle here at all. So I'm going to show you a model of this in which you can build a complex cell merely by connecting together a bunch of simple cells which have phase selectivity, but then collectively they lose their phase selectivity because they amplify a non-selective mode. So this is a recurrent model of complex cells. Let me plug this in so it doesn't die on me. Which I will run for you, and then we'll be done. Okay, so I'm going to start off with this model. It is exactly as it was before. So this is the Sampolinsky model, but I want you to reinterpret it again. It's handy as a spatial phase angle. I guess I even relabeled it. So in other words, this would be an example of a collection of simple cells coupled to each other and being highly spatial phase selective. So that angle there is not orientation anymore; it's spatial phase. Okay. And then all I'm going to do, I guess by pushing this button here, is to get rid of the amplification. So get rid of that cosine term that is amplifying this selectivity in this example, and change the uniform inhibition to uniform excitation. And what you find is suddenly a response that is only very weakly selective for it's not completely non-selective, but it's just weakly selective for orientation, and you've basically got yourself a complex cell. So this is a response, if you think of this as a single cell response, it's almost perfectly non-spatial phase selective, and it's certainly as non-spatial selective as a complex cell. I mean, you should never get the impression if you say complex cells are non-spatially phase selective that they really are. There's no such thing in neuroscience. They're always kind of a little bit, a little less, a little more. So here is a spatially phase selective cell, and you can do some of the classic experiments that are done. I'll do two of them and convince yourself that this is going to look exactly like a complex cell. So the idea in this model is that complex cells are just the cells within visual cortex that have strong uniform couplings to each other. They're the same as the simple cells, but they just happen to have strong enough couplings between them to have turned themselves into complex cells. So for example, here is the response. Was supposed to be a response of I guess it was doing it. Yeah, there it goes. Here is the response of a complex cell to a drifting grating, and sure it's drifting slowly. Must have been in a very mellow mood when I programmed this up. So here it goes very slowly across the screen. Maybe it slows itself down when it gets bored or something. Anyway, there it goes, and you can see that there's a uniform response. So this would correspond to the uniform response of a complex cell to a drifting grating. But I have actually a more interesting example of that. Let me do it here, which is the response to a counterphase grating, an oscillating grating, which I think I generate by doing this. Okay, so now that was a drifting grating. Now I'm going to do a counterphase grating. If you remember, it's a grating that turns from black to white to black, back to white to black, like that. And what you'll see, it's really funny. I think because it went on the battery, the processor slowed down or something. These are going much slower than they did. But anyway, it's probably good that it's going slow. So what you see is frequency doubling, if you look carefully. So this is going, here's, you know, it going up, going down, that's a half a cycle, and now it's going in, and it's going to be one cycle. Okay, there it goes, but this is going twice as fast, right? This is going down and up, that's only half a cycle, and it's back up, and then down and up, so it's doubled. So the oscillations up here is double what it is down here, so you get this frequency doubling effect. Okay, so let me just say some summary remarks and call it a day, and we're going to talk a little bit, but as far as trying to jam more stuff down your poor, tired throats, let's turn this off. You know, I feel very much, as far as these network models, that as theorists, we're accumulating results. We're sort of trying to figure out what these things are capable of, how we can train them up to do various things. Certainly, people are trying to apply them to specific systems, and you know, you're going to see some more examples of that. But we're almost learning the ropes here of what's going on. The critical thing for testing all of these models is, and I think Sebastian will probably come back to that, is a change in the experimental thing from extracellular to intracellular, and very much the 2 days of my lectures are the theoretical parallels of that. Extracellular recording, which has been done much, much more and goes further into the past in living animals, allows you to characterize the responses of neurons. You can tell, you know, you get so many spikes when you do this, and you get so many spikes when you do that, and allows you to build these kind of descriptive models like I did yesterday. But if you want to elevate that to the level of saying, well, not only can I describe the phenomenon, but I really know why it's happening. I really know it's because we have this current here and that current here and these synapses and all that. I think you need intracellular data to verify those sorts of models. You need to know, for example, whether complex cells are really, you know, coupled to each other strongly with invariant things. You need to know with phase invariant coupling. And so that transition has to occur, and Right now, intracellular recordings are very difficult. They're done, but they're very difficult in awake animals. But I think that may very well change. There are projects looking at being able to move electrodes, for example. A big problem with recording from an awake animal is just the pulse, the blood pressure of the animal, and those fluctuations cause the brain to move, and then as your electrode is trying to hold onto a cell, you know, it's not a good idea. There are various methods to make the electrode move along with the brain. By visually tracking the surface of the brain and moving the electrode appropriately. So hopefully that will improve and allow us to verify mechanistically what's going on. And as far as the modeling goes, I think, I don't know, maybe Sebastian can say something, that I feel like we're still in the learning phase of all the tricks that these networks are capable of doing. A big feature is not only to build them, but to train them up. I mean, I think because, you know, on a computer we can do everything we want, it's important to show, when you build one of these models, that could plausibly arise in nature. I mean, we've been discussing the problems of parameter tuning. You know, if you take 5 hours on the computer to adjust all the parameters, it's not clear that model is very relevant. And so often, to make a model believable, you have to not only build a model, but have some sort of plausible developmental or learning algorithm that would lead that model to exist in an actual brain. And we're still in the learning phase of that. So I don't want to overdo it, but maybe people want to talk and make comments on that. I don't know, Sebastian, you have anything to say on that? I guess you get your turn tomorrow, but
So being able to do intracellular recording, if we go back to your network equations, that means that instead of just measuring RI,
you mean this term? Yeah.
It's not clear that if you just look at those equations, is that a huge advance?
So yeah, why do you want to do that? I think that you can get a better idea of the synaptic input, right? You can look for conductance changes. You can look for the inhibitory component, the excitatory component. So yeah, I mean, you can start, you're not going to get every matrix element here, but you could start to look at how much excitation, how much inhibition is then there. I mean, it's not a cure-all. The problem, the thing that we're all struggling with, that we're going to never know, is I can't imagine us ever knowing all the inputs to a neuron, right? So we're always going to be dealing with a system where we're trying to explain the output without knowing the input. I think that's always going to be a fundamental problem, because it's kind of inconceivable that you could monitor the 10,000 inputs to a neuron. I can't imagine how that could be done, but you know, hopefully I'm wrong. The other thing that we're never going to know is the elements of this matrix MIJ, because it's a heroic task to measure, you know, one or two synaptic strengths in the brain. To measure again 10,000 of them, it's really at this point inconceivable. So those are the things we'll never get around, but I think we can unearth quite a bit about this input intracellularly that you can't just from looking at the spikes. I mean, at least you get a sense for what's coming into the neuron if you record it intracellularly. Whether extracellularly, you purely get the output. That's all you see. You don't know whether it's being inhibited. You just know it stopped firing or something like that. So that's kind of why I think that.
What's the most you would hope out of this model, even the nonlinear one? If you gave everything that you hoped for, what's the most you
can
give you? It doesn't seem like very much.
So, okay, I'll be very speculative, but I think that I'm not prepared to try to explain thought, right, in terms of the brain. But I do feel prepared, and we're prepared as a community, to explain sort of the dynamics, let's say, of cortex, of response. And it's incredibly unique. I mean, to me, it might be that the dynamic properties of cortex are so dramatic that just by explaining them without ever worrying about the fact that it thinks, we'll learn a great deal. For example, the fact that in cortex or in other regions of the brain like Sebastian, you can sustain activity, right, without any input. You can remember things and you can do it stably. How does that happen? Knowing that mechanism, that's a pure dynamics question. You don't even have to worry why the animal is doing that or how. that particular thing is a static thing. But okay, but I'll do a non-equilibrium one. The other thing about the amazing brain is it never stops, obviously. The activity never stops, never hits some boring fixed point. And yet, at the same time, is highly sensitive to input, right? So how do you have a dynamic system that keeps churning away, does very complicated thing, but like that, can suddenly change its state in response to perhaps a very weak input? That's, again, just a dynamics question. You don't have to say you're thinking when you do that. There are other issues, for example, like how do you always assure, like in a visual system, you know, there are 25 visual areas or something. How do you assure that they all get the signal of a visual input? You know, when we're driving, you see a little car in the corner. It's got to get all the way through your brain and propagate. It can't give up halfway through, nor can it start to blow up and give you epilepsy. That's not so easy to do, stable propagation in a system like that over a huge range of inputs. Again, just a dynamic problem that... So that's my kind of hope, that by matching dynamical features of, I just keep saying cortex, but of neural systems, we can get an awful long way, and maybe it'll become apparent how various behavioral tasks get done just from that. So, I mean, that's kind of... And that involves, I mean, I might have given a static example at first, but it involves dynamics. I mean, it's saying you won't got to get a lot more out of these networks than what we currently have, you know. So, you know, the activity in the brain is somewhere between kind of random and chaotic and incredibly organized, and it seems to exhibit both features at once. How do you make a dynamic system do that? Those are all questions that we should be able to answer, but they're really hard. I mean, I don't know the answers. But we don't have to know about consciousness and motivation and like that to answer those. They're all really dynamics, mathematics questions about a system that even just as a dynamical system, even if it never thought it would be amazing, just the fact that it can do these things dynamically. So that's sort of the good news to me. That I can think of a whole lot of questions that wouldn't require me to understand consciousness, and yet I think are still really deep. Consciousness, even thought. I think if you try to think of the brain and say, you know, how do we think, it's really hard. it's not even clear what we're doing with the stupid thing. But if you try to think of what does the activity do? How does it move around? You know, how does it respond dynamically? Then you can get somewhere. That's kind of. But you should shut up. And you should, yeah.
You focus mainly on dynamics, but after all, we could talk about vision and perception and memory. And the simple cell and complex cell, what they do, they decompose the visual world into the atoms of perception. Mm-hmm. Another very crucial theoretical question is, what is it good for?
Yeah, so actually, you know, I just finished writing this book with Peter Diane, and as a result, I know what you're talking about, because if I hadn't, I wouldn't. He has this very different view. I must say, I don't have this view, but I respect him, and I respect this view of saying the way to approach this problem. So what I was just saying is very much the opposite of that, is saying, like, forget what it's for, and just look at it as a dynamic system and try to model it and see what you learn. I think the kind of thing, what Peter has taught me when I was reading the book, is you can look at it as of saying completely functionally, like forget how it works and say, what would you have to do to recognize an object or something like that? Or what's the most efficient way to do it? And then do it that way. So it's completely backwards, top down. It isn't me, but you know, there's a lot of things I don't do in life. And that I think are worth doing. It's a very different approach, but it might work. I think I don't particularly like the optimization ideas. I mean, I'm not very moved by the fact that a whole lot of systems are optimized. Obviously, in some cases, things are optimized. But if you can really show that a calculation almost has to be done a certain way, well, then presumably the brain does it that way. So if you can find examples like that, then I think you can get somewhere. The problem is, if the problems really aren't unique, then you're not going to get anywhere doing that, if the solutions aren't unique. So, but it's another approach.
after all, the brain is a component of the other parts of the brain that do something else. And do you think that the visual system can lead us to the understanding of the brain?
There aren't practicing neuroscientists here. The quality of the work in the visual system is so much better than any other system to me. I don't know, Sebastian would agree. That you, not only the quantity of it, but the quality of it is so good and so much better than in many other systems that you're just going to be inevitably drawn to it, I think. And that's a pity that other systems are not as well done. But it's a dramatic difference to me about not only the quantity, but the quality of our knowledge in those systems. And I don't know quite why that occurred. I think it's partly a historic thing that Hubel and Wiesel, you know, made this big splash and did really superb work and set a standard in that field that really helped the field, you know, become, get a long way. So, I don't know, do you feel, Sebastian? That seems to be the auditory system problem, exactly, that it gets nonlinear too fast.
I think this nonlinearity is the essence thing.
Maybe all these decades we spent understanding linear behavior in early stages of visual systems actually distracting.
Yeah, that's right, it might be. But, you know, while you're trying to discover the solution to the nonlinear part, it's good to have something to be distracted by, to keep yourself entertained while you say, go against the brick wall there. Yeah? Yeah. So, of course, right? Initial conditions, not so much, because especially, you know, everything I showed you actually, as was pointed out, is really, you know, the stationary, the asymptotic state. So initial conditions had gone away by then. The boundary conditions, yes. And in all of the things I was showing you, in order to avoid edges, there were periodic boundary conditions because, you know, you're really modeling a little chunk of the brain, and you've artificially put in an edge when you do that. But of course, yes, and you know, you do the same things you do in any physical system. Do things like periodic boundary conditions to get rid of edges and like that. Actually, on Friday, Misha Sadek will talk about these associative memory networks, and in there, initial conditions are everything. That they really work by the basis of initial conditions. So that's a case, for example, where that's going to be really important.
In this model, since you almost onboard connections and for the subject of one
minute, how would you see these assumptions? Right. Yeah, well, that relates to the other. So this is clearly a model of a patch. I mean, the brain is not all connected, for sure. And even in V1, yeah. And so this would be a sort of hypercolumn model, for example. And you know, it's correct. This is actually a thing about firing rate models that's kind of nice, that other models have a problem with. And that is that you could argue, so, you know, we didn't talk about this, but neurons in the brain tend to be arranged in columns that go through the brain, and neurons sitting within here tend to have similar response properties, okay? But then next to them might be another column with somewhat different response properties. And often in a firing rate model, you can say, well, what you call a neuron, maybe, you know, you could think of saying, okay, I'm gonna just take, let's say, one of these neurons and represent the whole column by that neuron. Okay, so I'll just take an average, if you want, neuron, and you know, this thing could turn into just two neurons instead of thousands and thousands. In a firing rate model, it's relatively easy to do that, because you could just say, well, you know, this is like the average firing rate of all the neurons in there. And then when you do that, because this is representing the whole column, that will be much more highly connected than any individual neuron. It's like this neuron, you know, acquires all of the connections of all of those neurons within there. So I think it's sort of permissible to build a firing rate model that's much more highly coupled than its other. But as soon as you do that in a spiking model, you've got a problem. Because if you imagine this neuron being the representative neuron for the whole column, and you said, okay, well, it therefore acquires all of the couplings. So rather than having, let's say, a 1 in, I don't know, 20 chance of coupling to that, it's always going to couple to that because somebody in here always couples to somebody over there. If you do that in a spiking model, you got a problem, because when this neuron spikes, it's duplicating the effect of the entire column spiking in synchrony, right? It's a problem that you can average firing rates, but you can't average spikes. So people who build spiking models tend to build very sparsely coupled models, because if they don't, they synchronize. But in firing rate models, I think you can get away with imagining pruning down the numbers of neurons, but increasing the coupling to compensate for that. And so maybe you can think of it that way. Yeah?
I have a question about the relationship between the integrate or fire and the integrate and fire model. So in the integrate and fire, you were modeling the conductances caused by random excitatory and inhibitory inputs. That would give you the variation that randomized the output. In the integrate or fire rate model, is that variability explicitly?
No, yeah.
Modeling?
Right.
I think it was that first multiplicative term,
right.
But I just didn't.
Right. No, but this actually, Sebastian asked a similar question. I realize I hadn't been very clear. In that model, you completely ignore. So you're only saying, I want to understand how the firing rate is related to the part of the current that I control. And the rest of it is all swept under the rug. So it doesn't explicitly appear. It only appears in the fact that you're describing probabilistically what's happening. But that extra input is gone from the integrate or fire model. And it's absorbed into the parameters of the fit, you know.
So it would still be represented in the time constant?
Right. It would affect.
And the sort of
right. So, for example, it affects the slope of this function. This is an easy one. You know, we had this g of v function. So if you were in a non-noisy situation, you'd expect this to be a real step. You know, if you're above threshold, you fire. If you don't. And if you're in a very noisy situation, you might expect something like that, because the noise will work over a big range. So that's the example of a parameter that would be affected by the level of noise.
About the noise, it seems to be very important. But the noise is basically coming from all those many connectors.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take an evolution, I mean, I think there are some worms that have about 10 neurons or something. Do they work without noise? Is the noise coming from somewhere else?
Yeah, no, it's a good, like C. elegans works with, you know, 130 something neurons, for example. This is a little worm that maybe you're thinking of, where they know every single neuron in the thing. And this is a neuron that doesn't fire action potentials, not the kinds, it doesn't have any sodium channels. It's a really good question. That system, you would think, is working quite differently than our nervous systems. It doesn't have, I mean, even right from the start, I mean, I think the first thing I ever said was action potentials in these talks. We'll throw that out, you know. That's not happening. They may have calcium, what are called calcium spikes, which are sort of very slow versions of action potentials. So it would be really interesting to know how that's working. The problem is it's very difficult to record from those neurons. They are very small. And the other thing is that the animal is under very high pressure, so it tends to blow up if you try to open up it up. And there's these simple problems. People are starting to record from muscles in that preparation, and they'll get there. But it would be really interesting to know how that animal works.
So on the scale of evolution, where does it start to get noisy? How many neurons do you need that the neurons, the number itself, is the noise that you can use?
pretty fast. I mean, it's not even clear that that's the number of neurons. That animal doesn't happen to, it's probably size. That animal just doesn't fire spikes, for example. It's not clear that they're noisy. It's actually, those neurons may be very noisy because they're so small that they have a relatively small number of channels. They may have a lot of channel noise, those neurons. So I shouldn't even necessarily agree with you that that's not a noisy system. It may be noisy, but for a different reason. So they're tiny neurons with not that many channels. It may just be the fluctuations of the channels. You know, Hodgkinson model is assuming essentially the infinite limit of large numbers of channels. So you're deterministically describing a stochastic process. For these worms, it's probably not true. It's probably a lot of channel noise. Yeah, you had a question. I'm sorry. Yes, I've been ignoring you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's been suggested. I think Shadlin and Newsom, for example. I don't know if it's exactly what you're saying, but it's the same idea that if you take a model that has a firing rate curve like this, and you add noise, what happens is, of course, the threshold gets washed out, and so it tends to start looking like this. And in this region, if the noise is right and things are right, you can get a quadratic nonlinearity in this region. So people have sort of hand-wavily said, well, maybe that quadratic nonlinearity that leads to the kind of energy model I talked about is coming about by this effect. So yeah, you might be able to, I mean, I don't think anybody's really tried to rigorously build a model that way, but that suggestion has been thrown out.
No, because, I mean, with this explanation, one shouldn't apply to the biology, I mean, for another kind of connectivity. I mean, that
neurons surrounding the complex cell are more connected, or that the connectivity is different for the cell.
I thought the question was whether the certification could give rise to the second one.
Yes,
the
simple, yes.
So
there's.
The end probably
they
have to be small.
No, you know, you can. I mean, I talked about that yesterday. So this is what's called the Hubel and Wiesel model, maybe what you're thinking of. And David mentioned it, that you can build a complex cell by summing simple cells. So one way you can do it is just take a bunch of simple cells, you know, simple cell, with different phases and just sum them together, rectifying them. So it's exactly that this rectification on linearity will give you the double harmonic. And this is called the Hubel and Wiesel model because they said in one of their papers, there's various evidence that this isn't at least the whole story. For example, people can use stimuli that tend not to excite simple cells and still get complex cells to respond. And I mean, there's a whole debate about this. But I certainly didn't imply by that model it's the only way to build a complex cell. It isn't. Is always whatever you invent plus whatever Hubel and Wiesel invented. And they have a damn incredible persistence of being right, but I don't know if they're right about this one.
What's the motivation for the simple instrument model in terms of that tuning would be weak, and if there's any tuning, why would it be not just the right thing, so to speak? I mean, why?
Right.
Is there any specific reason for
it? I agree with that. So the evidence about that there was an experiment done in which the cortex was cooled. So in all of these models, what you would predict is if you could knock out the cortical circuit, if you could, for example, kill all those connections, you should revert to the model without any amplification. So that was done in an experiment from the Foerster lab by cooling the cortex. So if you cool the cortex, you can make it so it can't fire action potentials, and if it can't fire action potentials, it can't communicate. And what they found was that the amplitude of the response was greatly reduced, as if there's some sort of amplification going on. But the orientation selectivity was not reduced. So that was considered evidence, not very strong, but evidence against this interpretation. And in a way, I think it's kind of natural. Like, why wouldn't you tune the input? I mean, there's no harm in tuning the input and sort of match it with the tuning in the input. But I think that an experiment is often interpreted very negatively, but it shouldn't be, because they said in there, again, it's hard to interpret, but that there is amplification going on in cortex. And in a sense, it just raises the question, okay, what's being amplified? Maybe it's not orientation selectivity, maybe it's something else. But unfortunately, from our model of complex cells, we would have loved to see if complex cells turn into simple cells under those circumstances. But they didn't do it. They didn't look at complex cells. So we would predict that. If they stayed being complex cells, you know, here will Invisal rise from the grave again. Anyway, you can do those sorts of experiments.
But I mean, I would just add that I think that's kind of a, still the experiment is very open. Is to think, you know, they put on a stimulus, which was essentially one of these, you know, coffee making sticks. It was extremely oriented and was large in terms of the receptive field. And the flavor, I mean, the flavor of the experiment you need, I would say, from the Tomplinsky model, is just to sort of see the orientation, right? You're on a weakly oriented bar and see if you still get orientation preference.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point of that model, to do something that's kind of weak and to see if the cortical interactions magnify it.
Like yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Give it a harder task, right. Right. Yeah. I agree with that.
A question about is the recurring network, the lambda plus then one becomes a circular term. And I'm just thinking about non-linearity in the system in both the special even you have secular term.
You're saying secular term? So secular term is lambda equals one, right?
Isn't
it? Yeah, but it's an unstable term, yeah. Yeah, the nonlinear model can survive in that unstable regime, but it may do boring things like just go to saturation. Yeah. Okay, so yeah. So the model that Misha Sadix will talk about, this Hopfield, the associative memory model, it works like that. Everything goes to saturation. And yet it still has interesting properties. So it's just what you talk about. It goes to a saturated state, but there are many different saturated states, and which one it goes to gives you information. So there are networks that work, like you say, in the nonlinear regime where it's basically unstable, goes to saturation. Yeah.
What happens when the concentration and shape length are replaced by, let's say,
So, you know, the outer part, I was going to mention this. I'm glad, maybe this was one of the things I was going to try to remember to mention, that the outer product form is very much in the spirit of Hebb. So we talked about, you know, building an MIJ of the form some lambda times, you know, pick a vector. It doesn't matter. You just pick a vector, VIVJ. That if you think of this V as the activity part, pattern during training, right? This is saying, for example, if you have positive activity on the pre and postsynaptic cell, put a big number, positive number in for M, you know. If you have zero activity, put a zero here. So this is certainly in the spirit of the Hebbian type rule. So in a way, probably again, Misha, so we'll talk about this more, but these ideas are somewhat compatible with that sort of framework. All right, we go. Call it, right?
So what do you think is what's the most important experiment? If they're all important, then there's no most important experiment.
What's the experiment? The experiment of my dreams, particularly, there's two questions, would be to measure the conductances of neurons during various types of behaviors.
Something else though.
Right. Yeah. People are starting to do that, and it's really hard, and it'll take a while to die down. But that, personally, I will follow those experiments with great enthusiasm, and in a way, having them extend to more complex things, because again, conductance tells you more than just about this driving current. It tells you about, for example, offsetting excitation and inhibition. So for reasons I sort of haven't revealed, but I have reasons that to me. So what do you want to do? I mean, if you're I guess you're all theorists, if you're thinking of doing this field is a place where theorists can do a lot if they tie in with experiment. I mean, you can't lose if you tie in with experiment, and essentially you can't win if you don't. So it's as simple as that. But any lab that's doing good experiments, if you walk in, you're apt to find all sorts of data that needs to be analyzed by techniques that are more sophisticated than perhaps have been previously used in that lab. You'll find things ready to model. I mean, it's a really rich field for, to me, for things to be modeled. But the key is to don't sit, you know, in the computer lab and do it in isolation. You've got to find those experiments. I mean, David was just telling me about, you know, lock-in amplifiers in neural systems. And it's a great problem. How do you build a lock-in amplifier in neural systems? Okay, did I say the right thing? Yeah, it doesn't, yeah. I don't think so. Sebastian's talking about, for example, in these models, one of the terms was a uniform inhibition between everybody, which it models all over the place. Look at cases where the inhibition extends out longer than the excitation. The only thing is, it could be disynaptic. I think there's no evidence. In fact, it's probably reversed, that monosynaptic inhibition goes further out than that. But there's no statement here that it has to be monosynaptic, right? So then then who knows? Could be anything.
So the idea would be that the excitatory neuron
makes a long synaptic connection. To an inhibitory neuron, and then, right.
So yeah. There would have to be a special class of excitatory neurons that somehow makes the inhibition pretty useful.
Yeah, or, you know, sometimes you might say that the inhibition just sums everybody. Like maybe everybody kind of makes a collateral to an inhibitory neuron and then goes to their target, so that the inhibitory neurons just kind of sum up everything. That would be a way of getting this kind of term, maybe. Or the sort of normalization effects.
I've heard people do, I think in the day before they told me that he tried to experiment with just stimulating one area and he tried to measure the effect of stimulating one area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, that's very hard. So this gets back, this is why I showed you. Remember I showed you the after David's talk, right at the beginning, you know, see if you remember everything from. I showed you that these action potentials going both ways down axons, they'll go both ways. So this is a problem with that experiment. You know, you might say, that's perfect, wow, you generate activity over here and you look over there. You know, you should see what the cortex is doing, but you don't. Because when you stimulate over here, you generate backwards propagating action potentials on the axons of the guys going over here. So you stimulate this area in a completely non-biological way, what's called antidromic backwards propagation. And that could extend a sort of apparent excitation in a way that doesn't do it. I mean, sure, David, you know, knows about this and would say that, but. Yeah, right, exactly. So what people tend to want to do there is to spritz on an excitatory, like a transmitter or something, rather than electrically stimulate.
But this, okay, Bart Ehrlichman was here. I mean, he might argue that if on top of the dynamics that you described, there's actually some oscillation.
By
the time you get a little bit far away, you're about, you know, some fraction of a period, maybe a quarter period, which might be a wise case. So in fact, you're coming late, and effectively you're trying to flip the sign of the phase. It's effectively inhibition. I'm not going to make you happy.
One of the mysteries of the sociology of neuroscience is that people get incredibly interested with things that oscillate, and I'm not quite sure why. But anyway, you can tear it from Bard. I hate oscillations. Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. If it oscillates, I take it to the garage.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, so there are various people, including a colleague of mine at Brandeis, who would claim that bursts and spikes don't code for the same thing. And perhaps maybe bursts are more important information than individual spikes. And in fact, a way to sort of justify that is to use what are called facilitating synapses. So I haven't talked about this at all, but there are some synapses that, and maybe I'll just draw, that if you plot what I affectionately call W over time, well, in my models, this W, the synaptic weight, or MIJ, was a constant. But there are some synapses for which over time, if you repeatedly stimulate, it goes down, and there are other synapses for which it goes up if you repeatedly stimulate. And so if you used a facilitating synapse, you could get a synapse that essentially only transmits bursts. It could be very wimpy for individual spikes, but it could be quite strong for bursts. So, yeah, I mean, those ideas, you know, they're around. That bursts are somehow different or whatever.
Are you doing more for this company than
more spikes? Well, I don't know, predict. That's asking a lot. you know, what people, you know, this isn't my field, so I don't really know what all has been done in here. But certainly people have looked to see, for example, do you get more information by treating bursts as different things? I think there's a paper from Christoph Koch's lab in which they claimed that if you sort of treated bursts differently, not just like all the rest of the spikes, you'd get more information out and things like that. So, I don't know, I'm a little fuzzy on this, but I think that exists. Yeah. Yeah, so there's an interesting example that when you go to sleep, the thalamic cells, like these LGN cells, fire in bursts. Whereas when you're awake, they fire more, much more. I mean, it's sort of debated, but much more just individual spikes. So that makes a difference. Or it's a consequence. I know, who knows what it's a consequence of. And I finally stopped talking. Yeah, I hate synchrony even more than I hate oscillations and bursts. No, yeah. Well, you know, clearly a burst is a very powerful event, and a synchronized burst is a really powerful event. So maybe that's why you wake up in the morning, all those, you know, synchronized. All right. Well, thanks. It's been fun.